Welcome to Cellular Healing TV. I'm your host, Meredith Dykstra, and this is episode number 160. We have our resident cellular healing specialist, Dr. Dan Pompa, on the line, and today we welcome back Dr. Jason Fung. Dr. Jason had a very popular episode with us on Cell TV, and that was episode 112. If you didn't check that out, or if you haven't seen it before, you can watch it at podcast.drpompa.com and search for episode 112 there. And Dr. Fung is a fasting expert. So in this initial episode, we delved into the ins and outs of fasting. We talked about intermittent fasting and block fasting. And wow, you guys just love that episode. We have well over 200,000 views already on YouTube, and it's been in a lot of other places. So, and there was a lot of amazing feedback too. You guys loved it, but had a lot of questions. So wanted to do a follow-up episode with Dr. Fung just to kind of get some more questions answered on fasting. But before we jump in, Dr. Fung, what's new? What's been going on? You've had a few books come out since our last interview. So give us the update.
Yeah, so The Obesity Code was my first book. That was released in about February, March of 2016. And it really talks mostly about the science of what causes weight gain. And my whole thesis is that you really have to understand what causes weight gain, what causes type 2 diabetes in order to effectively treat that. And so at the end of the book, I touch upon intermittent fasting and also extended fasting, because the whole point is that insulin is the main driver of obesity. And one way to lower insulin is not with drugs, because drugs generally don't do that. But low carbohydrate diets work. But if you want to kind of get the ultimate, fasting, where you don't eat anything, really helps prevent the insulin resistance, which is the long-term problem. So I spent kind of the last chapter on it, but there's a lot to talk about in terms of fasting. There's lots of questions in terms of what regimens to use, what problems come up, what things to expect, because there are different things that happen, how long you need to get used to it, that kind of thing. So there's really not a lot of resources out there. So I co-wrote with Jimmy Moore, The Complete Guide to Fasting, which came out in October of last year, when it's, there it is. And this really is a kind of more, practical guide to like a how-to sort of book. Now it has a lot of the science of fasting, but it kind of goes with the other book, so you get a kind of complete understanding of why you're doing it and so on. And it's really answers most of the questions that probably have come up in terms of what to do about medications, what to watch out for, when you have to be careful, and those sort of questions. So that was October of last year, and it's been out for about a couple of months, and it's done very well. And I hope that people have, are able to read it and kind of take that information and kind of go forward and give themselves an option in terms of weight loss, because it's not like you have it. Well, you then terrific.
Broke up there.
So that was that kind of. Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Did he break up on your side there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A little bit of a delay.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, can you hear me, Doc? I hope you can hear me, but we get, Meredith has so many questions there, and I want to turn it to her, but, I'll just say this, first of all, thank you for your work. And, I became friends with Jimmy Moore, who I know put some effort into this as well. And, Jimmy, fasting has made a massive impact in his life, insulin resistance. And I would say, I can't speak for Jimmy, but just hearing him, fasting probably had the greatest influence, no doubt ketosis and those things, but, fasting really transformed him. And we can tell you, I'm training, hundreds of doctors around the country. Part of my multi-therapeutic approach is fasting. Block fasting and daily intermittent fasting. And Doc, we utilize all of them, and we've seen absolute amazing results. So, to have something like this book, that really gives people some basics and, really it is a complete guide to fasting. So appreciate the book, no doubt. I hope all of our listeners and viewers get it, no doubt about it, because fasting, I believe, is humans are meant to do it. you know, and because we were forced into it, right? Like you said, you know, is there a need for it today? I don't know. I mean, I think if you have challenges, I've watched miracles happen with fast. However, I believe that something happens with the gene code when we fast or forced into ketotic states and all these amazing things. So I think it's more to it than we even think. So with that said, Meredith, I mean, let's just go right after it. I mean, we all love fasting.
We sure do. And we got to walk the talk, right? So it is amazing, the amazing strategy. I have to thank you, Dr. Pompa. You taught me all about fasting as well. And I had a lot of fears, just like so many people out there, as Dr. Fung and I were speaking about before we started the episode, is that we just have to untrain our minds and our culture to have, you know, which has such fears around fasting. There's so much misinformation out there. So as we share today and continue to share, hopefully all of you will get more information on fasting and share it with those you love too, because it is a transformative strategy. So, yeah. All right. With that said, so let's jump in here. So many people, a lot of these questions were posted on the YouTube page for episode 112 of Cellular Healing TV. So I'll just kind of give an overview. We get this question a lot, but so does meal timing matter when we're eating, like during our feeding window? So when we're not fasting, does it matter if we eat breakfast and lunch? Or what if we just eat lunch? Or what if we eat lunch and dinner? Does the meal timing matter? Is it specific to people? Is a certain way of doing it, just like perhaps just eating dinner, better? Both of your thoughts there?
Yeah, I think it does make a difference. First of all, with everything, there's actually large inter-individual variation. So even though you can say one time is best, it may not actually be the best for you specifically. Mm. So you have to always keep that in mind. That is, and you see this with almost every dietary study. So you do a low-carb study, say on average people lose this amount of weight, but there's actually a huge splay, right? Some people lose like 50 pounds and some people gain like 10. So just because the average is a certain number doesn't mean that it necessarily is the best for you. So you always keep that in mind whenever you're looking at things. So we talk in averages because that's all we can do. If you look at the circadian rhythm, there's a natural kind of body rhythm. The least hungry you're going to be in the day is 8 a.m. And that's for several reasons. But one of them is that the body produces, just before you wake up, a counter-regulatory surge of hormones that includes norepinephrine and growth hormone and cortisol and your body for the day. So you're actually trying to get some glucose into the system and so on. And so you're actually not hungry. And this is when you look at large groups of people, you're the least hungry at 8 a.m., even though at 8 a.m. is the longest that you have been without food. So what you have to understand is that hunger is not merely the absence of food in your stomach. That's only one component. And this is one of the things that fasting has taught a lot of people, is that their hunger actually tends to go down the longer that they do the fasting. But 8 a.m. is the least hungry you're going to be through the day. So forcing yourself to eat at 8 a.m., if you're not hungry, is not a winning strategy, right? If you look at the nighttime, so late night eating, so 8 p.m. to midnight, for example, what you see is that for the same amount of food, you can actually get more of an insulin response. And insulin is the main driver for weight gain. So if you're worried about weight loss, if you eat late at night, you're going to have more insulin effect, and therefore it's going to have potentially more of a fattening effect on you for the same number of calories, right? So eating late at night is also not a good strategy. So if you want to know what the ideal is, I think it actually lies somewhere in the middle, eating kind of, if you're going to eat, say, one meal a day or have the largest meal, I think it actually makes the most sense to eat somewhere between kind of 12 to 2 o'clock, something like that. Now, that doesn't work for a lot of people, myself included. I'm like working and I'm not about to break up my office and go have a big lunch and then come back and do it. It doesn't work at all. So for me, yeah, I really have to kind of take that physiologic sort of what is best and kind of fit it into your life. There are other people who it doesn't, will eat mostly a big breakfast and do very well. So physiologically, I think I'd go with the large kind of mid-afternoon sort of meal if you're going to go with a compressed eating window. I think that is optimal, but you can do very well eating early in the morning. You can do well eating late at night. But again, you see some of this in terms of the folk wisdom. You see a lot of people who have always said throughout the years, oh, make sure you don't eat kind of right before bed because all that's going to turn into fat. To some extent, that is true. The late nights, and I would avoid the early mornings because it's hard to really kind of just force feed yourself.
Mm-hmm. Well, so what does it mean that I'm just following up on that? If you wake up really hungry, what does that mean?
It doesn't really mean anything in specifically. I mean, everybody's different. So some people, and I've treated a lot of people, they say, well, I do best eating a big meal, a big breakfast. I'm like, well, you know what? If that is what works for you, go for it. But on average, people are not as hungry at 8 a.m. as they are kind of in the midday. Mm-hmm. So a lot of variation. Got to find what works for you.
Hey, I'm going to put this, by the way, my view on that is exactly the same. I have some people who, you know, even their schedule, right? I mean, their schedule, it has to be successful even within their work schedule, their social schedule. So a lot of that determines it, you know, can they stick with it? So, you know, we want someone to stick with it, you know, first and foremost. And I agree. I think the perfect big meal is the European way, right? I mean, sometime in the afternoon, late afternoon would be optimal. Again, I've switched my eating window from maybe like one, and then I get my, I tend to eat more at that time now, and then a lighter meal, say around five. So I've kind of switched that around, but it doesn't work on the weekends for me. My wife and I go out to dinner, so on the weekends I switch it up. But so you don't even have to do this the same thing every day. But I agree. Most people carrying the fast through the night, not eating right away in the morning, I think for most people that works best because most people are not hungry in the first thing in the morning. So I agree. Hey, I'm gonna Facebook Live this. I'm gonna put up there. So go ahead and ask the next question. I think people would love this. So go ahead.
All right, awesome. In the middle of a pod, we're podcasting, recording, Facebook Living. You're loving the social media lately, Dr. Pompon. Well, I just kind of wanted to follow up on that too. So if you're suggesting possibly like a larger meal in the middle of the day and the European way, they suggest a siesta after that. What kind of effect would that have on our body composition or insulin response, if any? I'm just curious.
I don't know that there's a lot of data on the siesta, but certainly the kind of old style European, because you know a lot of Europeans are kind of switching more to an American style eating schedule, I think is ideal. They tend to have kind of a big midday meal and then very light dinner. And I think that works very well. The siesta, personally, I think is great in terms of stress reduction, which is one of the things that is never really talked about a lot, but clearly, there's an effect. All these stress hormones, and if you're under a lot of stress, people gain weight, right? If you're not sleeping well and you're under a lot of stress, you gain weight. So we know that there's an effect of these stress hormones. So I wonder often.
Yeah. Healing TV episode, but I wanted to bring you in live because of the topic. So Jason, meet the Facebook Live people. They're going to be watching. So, so anyways, go ahead, finish your point. That's all.
That's perfect. Yeah, I mean, as we were just talking about the siesta, and I think personally, I love to sleep like a couple hours in the afternoon when I can, and it happens like once a year, right? Like sometimes on a Sunday afternoon, I'll go, oh, okay, this is like awesome, right? I find it just so relaxing. Like sometimes I'm at the cottage and I get a little nap in the afternoon. And like that is like the best, like I feel like all like year, right? Because it happens like two times a year, right? My kids always want me to take them fishing or something, right? So I think that there's actually something to that. But I think that the siesta specifically more relates more to stress and relaxation and so on. The problem, of course, is we go to these kind of 24/7 worlds where we're always working, we're always checking our emails, we're always worrying about this, we're always worrying about that. So one of the things that really is important is to kind of unstress yourself and be aware. I think to some extent, lifestyle. It's disappearing, though. You know, the European kind of relaxed kind of lifestyle, it unfortunately is disappearing. But on the other hand, if you are able to kind of incorporate some of these ideas, I think that's great. The number one, and just following up with Dr. Pompa's idea, is that our number one rule for fasting is really to fit it into your life and to really do something that you can stick with long term. Because if you do these longer fasts, but it completely breaks up your normal, you know, dinner with your family, and you're not going to social events because you don't want to eat, that's not the idea. The idea is to do what you normally do. You slot it in. If it's a lot of shorter fasts, right, maybe a 16-8 sort of schedule, then that's what you should do. Not try and force these schedules into your life and make it something a big deal. In the old days, in a lot of religions, they would have prescribed periods of fasting so it would fit into people's lives. So say Greek Orthodox, where they have lots of different fasting days, it does fit into their life because everybody in their community is doing it too, and they've already allowed for that Ramadan, which is the Muslim faith. So there's lots of different ways, or around Easter and Lent and so on. So there are lots of ways that people have used to build this into their way of life, but that is our most important rule, so that you can keep it up long term, because this is not something that you do for a couple of days. Healthy, kind of stay on top of yourself, right, to prevent the illness, not to let it all build up.
So Doc, you know, we know that research is showing, you know, why so many amazing things happen during fast. Healing occurs during fast, and that's why, as you mentioned, it's throughout history. I mean, every religious group fasts. I mean, everything, fasting, I mean, Hippocrates. I mean, we go back into history, and you know, we can see that fasting has been a part of healing in multiple ways, even emotionally. So, you know, today, I know the gentleman who won the Nobel Prize last year talks about autophagy and, you know, being this, all these bad cells dying during fasts and good cells becoming stronger. What are some of the other reasons that you have found in your research why so much healing occurs during fasting?
Well, I think that's absolutely right. So one of the really powerful things that people talk about now is the autophagy or autophagy. And related to that is this idea that everybody thinks that breakdown of protein is bad, but it's not. In order for people to stay healthy, what you got to do is break down all that old protein and rebuild the new protein. And that's how the body works. So if you look at bone, for example, our bones are not static throughout our lives. There are osteoclasts and osteoblasts. So you're actually turning over the bone. And that's a cycle of renewal, right? So if you leave that old bone on there all the time, it will become brittle and it'll snap. And it's the same with proteins. So if you can take some of that old protein, break it down, and then rebuild it, it's much better. So for example, if you think about renovating your kitchen, or you're renovating your bathroom. Well, the first thing you got to do if you renovate your 1970s bathroom is throw out that lime green bathtub that's sitting there, right? You simply can't build and put another bathtub on top of it. You got to throw it out, right? So you throw it out, then you build it again. And if you think about what fasting does, that's exactly right. So you have this process, which has been recently described, which is the autophagy, where you break down this old protein. But on the other hand, you secrete very high levels of growth hormone, which means that when you start to eat, your body is going to start building up this new one. So that's perfect, right? It's a complete renewal cycle. You're renovating all your new cells, and that's incredible. So when people talk about it, there's several different areas that people are very interested in. One is Alzheimer's disease, because we know in Alzheimer's disease, you have all this old junky old protein that's sitting around clogging up your brain. Well, what if you had a process where you could actually clear it out and get rid of that old junky protein and renew it? Well, that's amazing. And maybe has the power to prevent something even as prevalent as Alzheimer's disease. The other thing that people talk about is cancer cells. So cancer cells, your body, to throw out some of this old protein and so on, and get rid of it. Of course, the other powerful thing is that it lowers insulin, and which is very well known, is that it's a growth factor. So mm-hmm. if stuff is growing, or if you've got kind of fertile ground to grow cancer cells, then they're going to grow. So if you lock down the glucose and you shut down the growth factors such as insulin, it's like taking away sunlight and water, right? Those cancer cells just cannot grow in that kind of environment. So again, right. you have here something which is not a real treatment. It's preventative, right? And that's the way that we've always used it. Do, you know, a week, a year, a month, a year, a couple of days a week. The lid on all that stuff. But it's a cycle of renewal. So almost in that sense, it's almost got an anti-aging sort of property, which is fantastic, because this is what everybody's looking for, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
They're looking for this fountain of youth, and maybe we've had it all along, right? Isn't that crazy? Had it all in front of us all along. We just decided to ignore it, right? That's the crazy part.
Well, we know with fasting that certain genes get turned on for longevity, the CERT1 gene, for example. And we know that bad genes get turned off. And another study that was, I don't know, maybe it was 2 years ago, maybe it was last year, but they showed that during fast, your immune cells actually get depleted in a good way. And then because the body comes back in an adaptation, you actually make all these stem cells. So, you know, because it wants to regenerate these immune cells. So it makes better immune cells, stronger immune cells. It starves down the old ones, gets rid of them, and makes new ones via stem cells. So they were saying that with another reason fasting in cancer, or it works so well for cancer, is the stem cell connection. I'm sure you've read that study.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's many potential kind of mechanisms, not a lot of studies in humans, honestly, but so many interesting things that could come out of it. And really, as in medicine, you always look at what the risk-benefit ratio is. Hmm. Benefits aren't proven. Well, what's the risk, right? People have been doing it for thousands of years, at least since we became humans. So there's very little risk to doing it on a kind of regular basis, you know, not like, you know, all of a sudden just jumping out and doing a huge, you know, 40-day fast when you're on 30 medications, right? That's not what we're talking about, right? We're talking about doing it on a regular basis throughout your life, the way people used to do it, right? That's so the risk-benefit ratio is just off the charts, because the risk is so low when you do it on a kind of controlled manner with education. And the benefits are potentially, you know, look at the benefits, right? Diabetes, weight loss, cancer, modern medicine, right? It's
anti-aging.
Diabetes affects so many, anti-aging, like so much. And then people talk about it in terms of athletics, people talk about training in the fasted state, and, you know, all these kind of potential things. One of the things that I think is personally very interesting that's topical is also in terms of mental clarity. People talk about it in terms of being able to function better terms of your mental clarity, because everybody thinks, oh, you eat food to give you to let you concentrate, but it's actually the exact opposite. And everybody kind of knows that. You have this you eat a huge meal and you get this food coma, right? After Thanksgiving meal, you sit down and all you can do is watch TV. Whereas when you don't eat, your brain actually is able to work better. So people talk about this mental clarity, and people are using it almost as a biohack. So for example, a group in Silicon Valley, they meet together and they're young, skinny guys, right? They don't need any of this other stuff, but they use it because they realize that they can use it to function better, right? And if you're in a hyper-competitive market, hey, that means a bigger promotion, more money, right?
You and I in the last episode talked about on our busiest days, we just simply don't eat, right? It's like, and we go through, I don't even realize sometimes, like, oh, I didn't even eat today, right? Because I get so busy. But my focus, my brain works the best when I'm in a fasting state. There is no doubt about it. Many people watching this, Doc, are going to say, well, it's complete opposite for me. I don't know what they're talking about, because their cells are literally only able to use sugar very little fat as an energy source. They don't adapt. So when they go even 3 hours without food, they start getting dizzy, you know, angry, irritable, you know, but that's a pathology of the cell. Talk about that.
Yeah. And that does happen for sure. And it takes a couple of weeks for your cells to get used to it. So when you first do it and you're used to having all this sugar and your body runs on sugar, and then you don't give it sugar, you're going to be a little bit off. Just like when people, you have alcoholics, for example, and you get these, you know, withdrawal symptoms. So you have to let your body become accustomed to burning fat. Now, it's a lot easier to go from a very low carbohydrate diet to fasting because your body is already used to burning fat. So whether it burns fat in your diet or whether it burns body fat, it makes no difference. It's fat. So it just burns it. And we've noticed that people who come from that kind of ketogenic low carb sort of diet find fasting a very natural transition. They transition into it, no problem. But the people who eat kind of 55-60% carbohydrate diet, like they used to tell us in the American, you know, the dietary guidelines, they really have a hell of a time. But luckily, it only lasts for about 2 weeks, and then your body just gets used to the fasting, and then after that, it's like away you go. So certainly there is a period of adaptation, and people used to call it different things, the flu for
keto flu,
a week or two, where you just feel like crap, right? Because your body has no sugar, which it's used to, and your body is not yet used to burning fat. So you really got no energy. So you can't really think and that sort of thing. And it's interesting because if you look at the muscles, when you switch over to a ketogenic diet, for example, you see that you upregulate the genes that let the muscle oxidize the fat better, right? So you can actually stain for that. And you can see that when you go on to diet, hydrates or fast, which is fuel source to fat, but your muscles, for example, don't have all the receptors that they need to burn it properly, right? So it upregulates, you start to produce more of them, then you use the fat more efficiently, then you're kind of good to go. So it's about 2 weeks. We tell people it takes that much time.
So you're saying the muscles, you were kind of breaking up there. So for our viewers, I just kind of bring some clarity. You were saying that these receptors in the muscles and possibly in the liver, they become more efficient. They become active, if you will, and you may even develop more of them. So therefore, now all of a sudden, you know, you're utilizing fat for energy at a much better rate.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. And go ahead, Meredith. I know that we have a lot of questions from the last show, and these Facebook Live people probably didn't realize that we do have another episode. That we did. This is part two of an interview with Jason Fung. So go ahead and ask some of those questions because those are great questions. People had them.
Yeah, there are sure so many. Just wanted to follow up quickly though, because so many people do kind of pair the keto diet with fasting. And is the success of that likely due to the fact that the keto diet really tends to suppress our hunger from all of the fat?
I think there is that, because if you look at the satiety, I think this is quite interesting. If you eat proteins, there are hormones that get released, such as peptide YY, that will tell us to not eat anymore. That's satiety, right? So the same for dietary fat. So if you eat fat, you release cholecystokinin, which has the same sort of kind of satiety mechanism. And whereas if you eat a lot of refined carbohydrates, sugar and wheat, for example, you don't get that. And it's very easy to see, because if you eat a big, huge, you know, buffet meal, and then somebody says, well, you know, here, have another pork chop, you'd be like, well, I really can't do that, right? But somebody says, oh, hey, you want a cookie? You're like, yeah, sure, I could do a cookie. They might be equal number of calories, but you really see that the cookies really don't activate your satiety mechanism, so you can stuff it down. And this is what I call the sex stomach phenomenon, which is what we used to say as kids. Oh, people, you know, your mom would say, do you want a cookie? And then you'd say yes. And she'd say, hey, I thought you're full. And like, no, I have a second stomach for desserts, right? That's what we also used to say as kids. And it's true, because you can put it down, no problem. You can eat two cookies and some ice cream, no problem. And that's the whole idea, that if you go for a ketogenic diet, then you're activating all.
Nope.
Position to that. intermittent fasting. If you're doing shorter ones, like 16 hours, 24 hours, then you're going to naturally kind of go into that. And it's very, very easy. So yeah, I think the satiety mechanisms do play a big role. If you're coming from a very high carbohydrate diet, you know, this is the whole problem, is that if you eat two slices of white toast with jam in the morning, which used to be quite common because, hey, there's very little fat in that, right? Then you get hungry at 10:30. But if you eat a couple of eggs, you're not hungry until 12, right? And that's that satiety effect, and that's very important. So it was eating all those refined carbohydrates in the first place that led us to say, oh, yeah, you should just eat all the time. It's like, okay, but that doesn't make any sense, right, physiologically. So, yeah, absolutely. I think it's a lot easier coming in.
Yeah, one of the things I wanted you to address is that, you know, 5-6 meals a day, many people watching this still are hearing from their trainer or someone else to eat 5-6 meals a day. And what I always say is, yeah, it kind of works in the beginning. You know, you maintain your metabolism, and people can lose a little bit of weight and then they hang on to that, but it stops and then they don't lose weight. Now you're aging faster than you should. You're, you know, eating more, we know, ages you more, especially when you eat more often. So speak to that a little bit. I think he froze. His internet is in and out.
Shoot. Well, you could speak to it, and then we can can follow up with Dr. Fung.
Yeah, I would love to get Doc's, you know, opinion on that. I mean, just because I'm sure he hears that all the time. I mean, we say on this show is, don't eat less often. Because we know if we just cut calories, our metabolism does go down. So the premise of keep your metabolism up, eat more often, people do tend to lose a little weight in the beginning because they're so catabolic, and it kind of keeps their body from burning its muscle, and it keeps the metabolism up. But it's short-lived. It really backfires because you're not ever giving your body time to burn its own stored fat for fuel. And you know, when you're doing that, when you're not eating in an intermittent fasting state, whether it's fasting through the night, 16 hours, 18, 20, you're allowing your body to burn its own fat, and therefore you're getting a very constant glucose and insulin. And that's the key to living longer. It's the key to, and we know that. So, you know, ketosis was called the diet that mimics fasting, because you're basically getting this rise in ketones, you know, but it mimics fasting. I think that fasting itself brings a whole lot of different and more benefits than even does ketosis. Putting them together is magic as well. I think he might be back here. So,
yeah. Dr. Fung, were you fine? See, he's coming back on. And I think the satiety kind of component with the keto diet, as you know, we were just talking about too, is really key. I remember that study I had sent you not too long ago, Dr. Pompa, where most Americans are eating, you know, like probably 15, 18 times a day. And I just remember, I thought that was so shocking, but you know, most people out there aren't, you know, counting that handful of nuts they're eating or that half a smoothie they've drunk and those little things that they're having throughout the day, that still counts as food, and it's still spiking your insulin.
It is. And you're spiking insulin even if you ate a salad, right, or a handful of nuts. And again, you want to die sooner, you want to age faster, just, you know, eat. You know, I mean, honestly, I mean, every longevity study is basically done. The science shows eating less is the key. However, you can't just say, okay, I'm done eating. So really the key is eating less often. And then, you know, I had the opportunity to visit a hunting gathering tribe that ate one meal a day. You know, so, you know, it was the first I saw that. But, you know, again, I mean, even ancient Europe was two meals a day, right? And they had their dinner in the middle of the afternoon and, you know, later on in the day, another meal, but they didn't eat breakfast. I mean, so yeah, I mean, you know, I think that there's so many studies that show this, that we have it all wrong as far as the number, you know, eating more often. And it's just a fast way to age. So fast way to age.
Yeah. No. You were just watching them eat that one meal too, was it a massive meal or was it just like, it was a big meal, but it wasn't shockingly huge? I'm just curious.
Yeah. I mean, they sure did. They ate a lot. I have to say, it wasn't like it was this quick thing. But I think even when we look at any ancient culture, that mealtime is much, it's their social part of their day. So it almost tends to go on for a couple hours. right? So, and I do the same thing. Once I start eating, like let's say I'm going to eat at 4 o'clock today, you know, I can continue that process. I start with some cheeses and, you know, I start with, you know, maybe some nuts, and then it goes down. Then I sit down to the meal, right? And so, you know, a glass of wine, dry farm wine, but the whole process is a process, you know, mm-hmm. It's lifestyle. We're in and out, right? I mean, we don't even sit down, right? I think it really is, that one big meal wasn't like they sat down and got up, you know, 45 minutes later. So during that time period, they ate a lot more food. Imagine if you tried to eat all that in, you know, a half hour, it would seem ridiculous. But, you know, as you put the social end of it in, you eat longer.
Mm-hmm. Such an important point too, to just think of the joy factor as we eat as well, and to really enjoy it. I think sometimes when we're, you know, very health minded and health focused, it can just be a little bit legalistic. It's okay, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to eat my grass fed protein and my, you know, my coconut oil fried vegetables and my, my organic sweet potato for my starch, because I'm supposed to, you know, have my starch in the evening to carb backload, and, you know, just kind of taking the joy out of the experience. Whereas, you know, if we're just eating and having a few hours to enjoy it, where we're starting with the cheese and, you know, kind of have, oh, there's Dr. Fung again, hopefully we'll get him back on, have that beautiful experience around food, which we're meant to enjoy, then, you know, we can even get more benefit from the food when we eat it as well.
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt. Dr. Fung, are you with us?
Oh, shoot. See his picture.
You guys are wealth of knowledge. You know, I know one of the questions is, I mean, we get it all the time as far as, you know, can diabetics fast? Well, this is what Dr. Fung does. You know, he's fasting people with massive insulin resistance and diabetes, and his results have been more than spectacular. Obesity, you know, all of it. You know, they're fasting. So, you know, again, with amazing results. So, you know, I think that if we can, you know, get him back on, gosh, you know, we just really gain a lot.
And he said his Wi-Fi died again. So,
Something pulling from. Tell him to look at other things pulling from it.
So he's on a desktop now, just doesn't have a webcam. So, all right, well, Dr. Fung, if you can just do audio, that's great.
Yeah, fine.
So if you just want to speak, can you hear us?
Ask me another question that people had, because I really wanted this to be about answering their questions. So.
Okay. Well, so a lot of people were kind of commenting and having questions on the impact of fasting on the microbiome. A couple questions on how fasting could impact SIBO specifically, and general impact on gut issues, and how fasting can be healing for really specific gut challenges.
Well, you know, it's one of, in our category of ancient healing strategies. I always say you can't fix the gut with just giving bacteria, right? Fasting, we look at ancient healing strategies, right? Diets, ketosis, cellular healing diet, that's how you fix a gut. Fasting, intermittent block fasting, that's how you fix a gut. And even diet variation, that's how you fix a gut. So yeah, fasting is magical for the gut, because you're starving down all bacteria. And then, just like we said, we're starving down immune cells when we fast, and stem cells recreate stronger, better ones. Same thing's happening with the microbiome. We're starving down bacteria, and now we're able to create better, stronger, good guys, bad, you know, getting rid of the bad guys. So re-inoculating after a fast is a really perfect time to start eating some fermented foods and different things, you know, good, rich fibers that will feed the good guys as well. But just the resetting of the microbiome occurs during fast. And gosh, I would love to get Dr. Fung's opinion on that, because I know that he may even be a part of some of those studies. But, you know, just referring back to why people are sick, the gut today is damaged, the microbiome. We know that toxins are playing a big role here, and we know certain genes get turned on. The multi-therapeutic approach, we use these ancient healing strategies like fasting as really the key to how you fix a gut today in a microbiome. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. And are there more healing methods of fasting or liquids to fast on than others for gut healing?
Yeah, I think that, I always say that each fast is a little different. It's different for everybody. pure water fasting, you get the most autophagy happening, where you're starving down bacteria and bad cells. Broth fast, you get a lot of different electrolytes and type 2 collagen and different minerals that are amazing for the gut. And then we have whey water, which is a whole different type of fast that offers different fermented, different bacteria. So, I mean, many different types of fasts, which could be appropriate for people at different times. So I like to use a variety of different fasts with people, and the body almost gravitates to one over the other.
Mm-hmm. I remember when I first met you and started with the company and learning about fasting, I did the a 4-day whey water fast. And yeah. I found it to be, it was so healing, but so easy too. I couldn't believe it, because I thought the whey water was delicious, number one. But as you've said, number two, especially for those starting out, if you're listening, haven't done a block fast before, which means fasting for consecutive days, that the whey water can be very easy because the blood sugar stays balanced because of that lactose in the whey water.
Yeah, no, exactly. So it's an easy one for people to do, you know, because it's they're not used to using fat for energy, and those first 2 or 3 days, you know, can be hell. So the whey water is, you know, absolutely makes that easier. So, you know, I mean, I'm no doubt I'm a firm believer in water fasting. You know, I've studied it for years, and I think it's the most natural way of fasting. But partial fasting, in many ways, maybe just with some fats, MCT oil, coconut oil, with some broth, you're going to get a lot of benefits there too. I think I'm always asked this question, you know, well, how long should I fast? And I, you know, if we're talking about block fasting, you know, not daily intermittent fasting, which maybe some of our people are new to this, but block fasting, I like 4 days. And many people always just do a 3-day fast. But when you understand what's happening from a physiological standpoint, you realize that most of the magic happens on day 4. So why stop at the fast day 3? You know, it takes that adaptation to break through to where you're now actually producing really high ketones. And we measure ketones. Actually, this is one of the ways I do. This is a breath that looks at acetone in the breath. And then, of course, we can do the blood prick too, which I do. Right now I'm doing some experimenting with both. But you know, we're able to see higher levels of ketones on day 4, which, again, ketones turn off bad genes. Ketones heal the brain. Ketones are remarkable for, you know, all types of different healing, you know, that it's occurring in the cell. So if you tested your ketones, you would realize, why would I stop day 3? So at least day 4. And then from there, I, you know, will even put people in maybe a partial fast, where they're not doing any more than 300 to 500 calories in a day. It could be from broth, fats, avocado, some very light foods, maybe some eggs. But yeah, so going from a fast to a partial fast, the healing will still occur. And you can tell because their tongues will change. Some people don't have a lot of nutrition stores to, you know, that they, it's very difficult for them. But in a partial fast, you'll see their tongue turn white, yellow, green, you know, where the body says, you know what, I'm good with this. I'm going to continue the healing. So anyways, yeah, I hope Dr. Fung may not be able to join us again.
No, unfortunately his Wi-Fi's dropped and he doesn't have a mic, and I'm just really not sure why he can't get back on. So
yeah, we'll have him again, but let me answer some more questions. We'll finish out the hour here. And while you're doing that, I'll just kind of show, let's just go ahead, answer me a question.
Hey, let's see what your ketones are right now. We'll check where you're at, Dr. Pompa. So awesome. All right. So, well, one of the questions, how can people avoid weight gain post fast? So I think this is kind of more in reference to block fast versus the daily intermittent fast, of course. But okay, so they're doing this fast for a couple of days, which I wanted to make that point too. Once you're kind of on day 3, day 4, I mean, your hunger really does shut off at a certain point. So it's not like you're starving the whole time, or if you are hungry the whole time during a longer block fast, then maybe there's something else that's kind of more broken at the cellular level, I think. But anyway, just to kind of, so if they've done a longer fast, you know, 3-4 days, hopefully have hit that 4-day mark, and they want to avoid the weight gain post fast, what do they do?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, you know, you don't come off of a fast and, you know, go into the standard American diet. You know, that would be a waste. You don't break a fast too hard. You break a fast very gradually, of course, very slow and low. And soft foods, blended foods, you know, some cooked, believe it or not, raw is, you know, harder to break down even than cooked vegetables. So soft cooked vegetables. I mean, you know, that's really the appropriate way to break the fast. Avocado is perfect. You know, so, you know, it's what you do post fast. You know, that's what, why you wouldn't gain weight. So, you know, you move right into ketosis. I love taking people out of a fast. You know, they're forced into ketosis in 3 days, right? They're, all of a sudden their ketones are going up above 0.5 on a blood, measuring hydroxybutyrate. Now, you know, when they start eating again, you'll see a drop in that, but then, you know, they'll start rising right back up and end up in ketosis. That's an easy way not to gain weight after. So utilize that to force your cells to use fat for energy by going into ketosis. So that would be one of the best suggestions I have.
Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah. And it's what you do after the fast. That is so true. So, all right. Okay. Well, Dr. Fung, well, we're going to reschedule with him, but yeah, a few more here. So I thought this was kind of an interesting question. It says, hi, how do you explain vegans or people who eat high carb, low fat diets and have normal blood sugar levels? I'm really curious about this because I've tried both low carb and high carb diets and honestly, neither worked for me. I've had continuous elevated blood sugar for a few years now, and I don't know how to lower it. I also have an 8-hour eating window for the same few years, and it didn't seem to work. Do I need to fast for a longer period of time, or what could be going on?
With every fast, more healing occurs. So, you know, every fast, your body gets more and more efficient. More bad cells die through autophagy. Like he was saying, the receptors become even more responsive. You know, you even develop more receptors. So with each fast, more efficiency. I just did a Facebook Live yesterday, and I talked about this with Marilee, because Marilee was not successful in breaking through even in ketosis. So her glucose would remain a little high and her ketones would not rise up. This time, and again, now it's been whatever years intermittent fasting and, you know, different daily fasting. And now what's happening is her glucose is dropping and her ketones are rising. But it took some time to get in. She wasn't sick. She wasn't diagnosed with diabetes by any means. But no doubt about it, she had some hormone resistance, which is what we see in a lot of women during perimenopause, thyroid issues, etc. And I'm often asked that question. Is it harder for women? And scientists seem to say no, but I say clinically yes. You know, so we see that. But that doesn't mean that you can't break through. Now, the other part of that question was, why do you see some people that on maybe a vegetarian diet with, you know, normal blood glucose? Well, I mean, again, a vegetarian diet could affect you other ways, not just with an insulin resistance, right? So, I mean, and again, if you're doing it right with a lot of fiber, that would control your glucose too, right? But that doesn't mean that eating all day is healthy. You could end up not having diabetes or insulin resistance and aging prematurely, because the more often you eat, the sooner you're going to age. So, you know, and it's going to be a little different for everyone. Right now, we're kind of doing a study with Dr. McCullough and some of our platinum doctors. We have them hooked up to what's called Dexcom, and that measures your glucose all day and night. And we have a gal who's going in ketosis right now on a vegan diet. So just because you're vegan or vegetarian doesn't mean that you can't go into ketosis, and we're actually proving that. You know, there's plenty of fats in vegetable form, and it's still about carbohydrates, right? Net carbs, you know, meaning that you're going to get a lot of fiber, and you just keep your carbs low and your fats high and your protein moderate, boom, you're in ketosis on a vegan diet. So pretty neat. But, you know, and again, I'm not saying that anyone, we should be in ketosis all the time. I think that I got some slack at the carb conference I spoke at, you know, but the point is that.
But good for you for sharing on it.
Yeah, right? I mean, every culture was in and out of ketosis. The moment they could get out for any reason, you know, more root vegetables or berries, whatever it was, they did, right? I mean, they were human. But I believe that these times of ketosis are really necessary to to reset our DNA, to change our epigenetics. You know, I think that we're learning that these times in ketosis are very, very needed in humans. by the way, many cultures went into ketosis because they lacked food. They were fasting or partial fasting. You know, the Hunza people, it was starvation spring. Out of food, the Indians, same thing. So fasting or just shifting to a diet higher in fat happened because it had to happen or it was forced to happen. Today, we're loaded up with carbohydrates constantly. So when I move into a higher carbohydrate diet, I'm not saying moving into, you know, it's still considered a low carb diet, by the way. It, you know, whether it's 100 to 150 grams of carbs a day, that by American standard, for me, that's higher carb. But for the American standard, that's still low carb. My gosh, the average American gets 100 grams of carbs for breakfast, for goodness sakes, pure sugar. So anyways, maybe there was some more questions you had there. Those were good ones.
Yeah, it is crazy. I'm hearing a lot of echo.
I don't hear your echo.
No. Okay. Just hear my echo. All right, great. All right. So let's see here.
Okay. Here's a question. Here's a live question. Can I take a live question?
Bring it on. Yeah.
Yeah. Gina said, is it wise to force your body into ketosis when you have elevated cortisol levels since ketones alone stresses the body? Since ketosis alone stresses the body. No, because we actually see a lowering of cortisol. Because what happens is fat and ketones burn much more efficiently than does glucose. So what happens is, and remember, a cortisol rise is a normal response at certain times of the day. So it's not like every cortisol rise. Now, hypercortisol is not good. However, we know that we get this leveling off just because we're switching the cell energy from being glucose driven, which drives up oxidation in the cell, to fat or ketones, which lowers it, which is taking a metabolic stress off the body. Now, I would say this, for those people who have more adrenal fatigue, they need more electrolytes, because during when you're breaking through an adaptation in ketosis, switching from sugar burner to fat burner, you will deplete glycogen, and the glycogen going out will bring some electrolytes with it. So magnesium, potassium, sodium, you know, make sure you get this, even zinc, you know, definitely elevate that level. Salt intake helps hold on to potassium. So we increase the salt. But by the way, salt is fantastic for your thyroid and your adrenals. So, you know, just support with some extra, at least 2 teaspoons of sea salt a day when you're especially breaking into ketosis, and you will have success. So great question. Bring some more questions.
Awesome. Thanks, Gina. Great question. Yeah. So we get this a lot as far as during the fasting or the feeding window, the proper number of calories to eat. And I know that maybe dependent on goals and there's a lot of different variables, but how do people kind of have a gauge for how many calories to consume during that fasting window to meet their needs?
So I showed this article in Scientific American, and the article, you should get this, Meredith. Workouts and weight loss, right? Learn the surprising evolutionary reason why exercise alone won't shed pounds. So, you know, in this, they were stunned because they measured the caloric output of one of these hunting-gathering tribes in northern Tanzania. So these people, you know, they did the one meal a day thing. They all day, the men were out chasing down game. I mean, they literally exhausted, right? Just like the tribe that I visited. And the women are out gathering. I mean, they're just gone. I mean, it's unbelievable the amount of work they're putting in a day. So they measured their caloric output with the most scientific way, the most accurate way. I think it's called the doubly water test, but it measures CO2, and it's the most accurate way of looking at how many calories someone burns at the end of a day. You know what they found? For men, whether you were in this tribe, these men in this tribe went all day long, burned 2,500 calories a day on average. Guess what? Compared to the average American couch potato, it was the same. So humans were genetically burning about the same amount of calories. Ladies, it's about
really?
Yeah. So I think then my answer to that would be, why ingest more than 2,500 calories? Unless you're a bodybuilder who's trying to put on muscle, then you're going to want to take in more calories, right? Because you're trying to transition that into muscle. Now, I think you're giving up some health benefits when you're doing that, right? I mean, so to become larger, more muscular than you know the average human or your average metabolism DNA wants to be, you're going to have to eat more calories. So the bottom line is that if this is no matter what we burn, whether we're sitting on the darn couch or whether we're chasing down animals all day. So I think it gives us a good idea. In your eating window, you know, anywhere between 2,000 and 2,500 calories is probably where you're going to end up as far as what you need or want to be satisfied. I think it could be less. I think some people might have a lower metabolism. Remember, these are averages for very healthy people. Unhealthy people, you may be a male burning 1,800 for all I know, right? I mean, you know, this, again, that was a study done on a very healthy, thriving tribe that's able to burn that genetic maximum human. By the way, when they looked at primates, apes in the zoo burned, the primates were half of the human caloric burn at the end of a day. So basically exactly half, but apes in the zoo burned the same amount of calories as apes in the wild, despite being so much more active. Crazy, right?
Fascinating. That's amazing. Yeah. That just with such different lifestyles and activity levels that it would be the same. So it just speaks so deeply, I think, to an innate intelligence that regardless of our situation, you know, our bodies adapt. So it's really incredible, that information. I love that. So do you have time for a few more questions or do we need to wrap it up?
Yeah, I mean, good. Give me a couple more questions, and maybe some of you on Facebook, share and like this, guys. I know you've all had a lot of questions about fasting and ketosis. This is a way to transform many conditions. You heard Dr. Fung in the beginning of this talk about all these benefits, and I wish we were able to keep them on. I'll bring them on again. But share and like this with your people there. But anyways, maybe I'll get another question from here, but fire one more off me.
Yeah. So I think this is interesting too. So just curious to your thoughts, Dr. Pump, on fat fasting. So this is kind of a technique I think some people use to break into ketosis and to burn fat, where literally for days on end, which I think I've done this for at least a day or two, where you're literally eating nothing but fat. So perhaps you're eating like literally just a stick of butter with sea salt or straight up coconut butter or coconut oil, like literally eating pure fat for at least a day, maybe multiple days on end to break into ketosis and to burn fat. So what are your thoughts there? Is that a healthy thing to do?
Yeah, no, I think it's a great, I would call that a partial fast, right? You're not purely fasting, but you're eating fats. I've done that with several of my clients, and, you know, especially for people who just are so unhealthy at the cellular level and their mitochondria that they, you know, breaking through for them would be difficult. I would add some of these MCT oils, coconut oils, some ghee, some of these, you know, really sustaining fats. And, you know, they did good. They still got a benefit. And then the next time they fasted, or maybe two times later, then they were able to do just pure water. So, you know, it could be a strategy, you know, to break through. A little bit of broth and some fats is a nice modified partial fast.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, easier to maintain your insulin and your blood glucose levels and kind of a transitional type fast. So that's great. Now, and this was kind of talked about a lot too, unless you have some other questions coming in.
No, I don't have any other coming in. So.
All right. So, well, and so we were just kind of wondering about longer term fasting and if there's dangers to that, or I know we've talked about this a lot, but just kind of really digging in for people who just aren't getting results with intermittent fasting, shorter term fast. They're just, you know, seeking maybe to do a longer term fast, but also a little bit nervous about it. Can you speak to that?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think that first of all, to do a longer term fast, you need a professional practitioner who understands fasting, right? Because, you know, no doubt, intermittent fasting daily, I think that's a completely different animal, but, you know, things can change. Electrolyte depletion can occur, and then, you know, you must break the fast. So longer fasting, definitely supervised, but you'd be stunned. And I realize this right now, I have another call I have to get on, but you'd be stunned at how long people can fast. Tell them the other episodes that we did with Dr. Dempsey fasted 22 days, another doc with 30 days. But you can refer to those episodes. So I'm going to sign off here and go ahead and refer to those episodes on cellular TV.
Right. And no, I'm not sure of the numbers exactly, but if you go to podcast.drpompa.com and water fasting done right is with Dr. Derek Dempsey. He did a longer 22-day water fast. And with Dr. John Klum, he also did about a 30-day water fast. So we're about maybe around the 110, 114 marks for Cell TV. And we'll look those up and make sure they're in the show notes correctly. But those are definitely key episodes to check out as well for those doctors who did longer fasts and got some really interesting results. So thanks awesome. So much, Dr. Pompa, for the awesome answers. Thanks everyone for the amazing questions. Stay tuned. We're going to get Dr. Fung back and dig into more of your questions for him. And have a wonderful weekend, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody.